session number 9927, reel 10.
Hemsley, reel 10. You were saying about the flying bomb and what a difference this made.
Flying bombs were terribly difficult, as everybody knows. We put up a barrier of balloons with the object of catching the plane passing through and catching on the wires. They might have done so occasionally.
This was to give you the signal that they were coming, is it?
No. This was to catch them. The balloons were there to catch them.
And to down them?
Yes. They were supposed to hit the wires and come down. It must have happened once or twice, but not very often. You'd have to have so many balloons and so many close together. It was just one of the items. But there wasn't a lot that we could do from the gun point of view except to fire it at aeroplanes. Flying bombs, of course, were a different problem. But we managed to get those down in a different way, really. We were able to, our own Air Force were able to deal with them. I don't think that it would be appropriate for me to go into the problem of dealing with flying bombs, because...
Well, it's only so far as your signals are concerned.
Yes, well,
you see, what difference it made to your signal?
Well, it didn't make much, for the simple reason we'd got all our communicators working well in those days, and we kept our guns fully employed. And that's the only way you can look at it from the signals point of view.
Yes. I know, you know, that obviously there's documentary evidence. As you've explained, this is very highly technical, that the development and the systems you were using. But it's very interesting for us, I think, in as much that you started out with signals in World War One, and also went into this in World War Two. Did you notice an enormous difference in the sort of methods and technology between the two world wars? You know, did you have much more sophisticated machinery in World War Two?
Well, World War Two undoubtedly was a complete change over to more modern ideas. I mean, in World War One, we depended on just one army telephone in a little wooden box that worked fairly well. We relied upon running our communications overhead. But, of course, I think we have to take into consideration that I am discussing with you World War II in London, nowhere else, except for the last few months of the war when I went with my people down to Colchester for the last effort of the Germans to carry flying bombs on bombers across the North Sea and dropping those on the East Coast. It was their very last struggle, and we took our guns out there and I did the communications for them and they shot them down, and that's that. But except for that, everything like this was happening at the centre of London, and I was there the whole time. Can't think of anything that especially goes into that. Yes.
You were also explaining that this was your first experience of having women working in your department. Did this present any particular problems for you?
It presented many problems, but on the other hand, it was a great success. The girls were housed in different separate houses of their own off the Brompton Road, and they were under the control of a senior commander, ATS, who worked in an office beside me, and we worked closely together with any problems. Anything there was a feminine problem or discipline problem, she dealt with. I gave orders, but I had rather an interesting condition there, as a matter of fact. The Signals band was coming to London, and I had planned to have a church parade with the band leading my troops to church. Mixed troops then, of course. And they, at the last, almost the last minute, the general, not my general, but the London general, gave an instruction that the London field signals should have the band, not me, not anti-aircraft. So I went and told our padre, the clergyman there, marvellous man. He said, "Who's in command of them?" I said, "Well, there's the general of the London control." He said, "I'll go and see him." So he went and he told the general. He said, "Look, I have printed hymn sheets and I am supposed to have the signals manned." He said, "Well, I've made inquiries, but I don't want to upset them." He said, "Would you like another band? Would you like a guards band?" I said, "I don't mind what the band is." He said, "All right." He said, they then told me, "You can go to the Brigade of Guards and make arrangements for a guards band," which I did. And so the first Sunday of every month, I marched my men and my girls and behind this magnificent band, the full guards band. And I had each of the guards, I had the Welsh, I had the Scots, I had them all, one after the other. And until the end of the war, every first Sunday in the month, you would see me leading my troops with the guards band. And it gave a terrific morale boost to both my troops and to my girls.
Did you have any problem because of the mix of sexes? You know, girls and men working together. Did this create a problem at all?
Well, I'm not quite sure that what sort of problem one can take. What I can say is yes. The problem was that in my officers' mess, some of them certainly became very friendly, and one or two of the married men seemed to be very friendly with the unmarried girls, and I had to draw the line. But it was not my responsibility. It was the senior commander, and the ATS system had to look after that side of it. I wasn't there to look after the girls' behaviour. I was only there to get the girls to do the work I needed.
You were saying earlier, you know, that they did a very good job. You know, was this at all surprising, you know, that women could perform so well in that sort of work?
Not really, you know, because they were more or less, some of them were telephone operators. As a matter of fact, it was like being a telephone operator, you see. No, the main point of it was discipline, you see. For instance, as I say, every Sunday morning, now I decided that as it looked like rain, I notified the senior commander, "You better tell them to wear their overcoats."
This for your march?
Yes, for the march,
yes.
And to church, you see.
Mm.
And so they fell in with their overcoats, and the sun came out blazing hot, and I said to the commander, "I don't think they look at all smart in that awful overcoat. Just arrange for them to hand their overcoats to the girls adjacent to the end, and the last girl will carry these coats all back, and then we'll go off to church." So she stood there looking rather interested, and then she said to her whole troop, "Remove overcoats, pass to the left." And they took their overcoats off, looking very red-faced. Half of them had deliberately left their tunics off, and they were still in shirts and even undershirts in some cases. And they looked as a scallywag lot. So I had to send them all back to get their tunics on, you see. Some years after, when the war was over, they formed an association and they begged me to come along. And when I got there, they gave me a terrible wigging for what I'd done to them on that occasion. Royal Air Force control, and a separate building was the anti-aircraft guns and searchlight control.
And you had something to do with that?
That was mine, not the other one. I went and looked at there. They had an enormous control centre up there. But this was only an administrative centre for the entire London area that we had, which was Stanmore House.
Yes. And how did that fit into your London operation?
Well, it was an administrative headquarters with the general there, and they didn't give direct orders to individuals. They ran the whole affair from there. We had a brigadier there. The man who commanded the signals before me was Brigadier Wickens, a great friend of mine too, and he became their brigadier responsible for the communications side of the gunnery and searchlights. Of course, he's dead now, like everybody else, unfortunately. I'm sorry to say.
When you look back, you know, to your signals and your secret headquarters and the operation of this in World War II, you know, are you satisfied that you know everything that could have been done was done in the way of signals for the London area? As you've explained, you can only talk for London.
Well, I'm fully satisfied with that, because actually, with the post office giving us their plant and keeping it working for us, the responsibility was with them. The bomb that fell in the street and smashed the cable that took, amongst other things, our telephone lines, we had to rely upon the post office to put it right again. And so they were responsible for that. But when it came out at the ends, it was ours, you see. But all the intermediate communication was with the British Post Office. I demanded some special help on one occasion that I wanted, and the post office were being difficult. And I rang the assistant engineer in chief of the post office, whom I knew by name, and I said, can I ask you where you live? And she said, I live out at Putney. And I said, well, tonight there'll probably be another bombing raid. The bombers will all come in. Some of them will concentrate on Putney, maybe. And I want all these lines through by then. All right, I'll see you again. But everybody else would refuse it. But when I warned him, he was good enough to organize it. We had many interesting visitors at our secret headquarters at Brompton Road. We had General Smuts, the Prime Minister, and many others, but best of all, King George VI when he came. The General rang me in the morning and said, the King's coming for 30 minutes, a quick visit this afternoon. And I said, shall I have tea available? But no, he said, he won't stop for that. So at 3 o'clock, I was standing there with the general, and the king came out from his big car and handed me stick, cap and gloves, and then proceeded with the general to be shown control rooms, and he watched the girls at work and the controlling movements. But when we took him down below, 80 feet below, where we had all the automatic equipment, he saw a man working with his pliers at a frame, main frame, and he pulled up a box that was nearby and sat by this man and had a heart-to-heart talk with him about his work and what he was doing, everything that he could find that would be of interest, while the general and I stood nearby. And when eventually he quite reluctantly got up, he looked at me, came to me and he said, surely this is a tube station? I said, yes. But can't you see the trains? I said, one can. We don't normally go there. I would like to see them. So the general left King and I, and I took the King up to a point where we undid heavy bolts all the way down and worked our way in now to the old passages to the platform. They were black with soot. Hanging from the walls were the old theatre notices. I remember one was for a well-known play at that time. And then we reached the platform. And fortunately, the trains going through there were all slowed up by a signal beyond our station, which made them go slowly by and then pick up speed afterwards. And as those trains went by, the king stood there with folded arms and watched them. None of them could see him in the darkness. Probably the light from the train was just shining towards him, but not enough for anybody to see him. And so for the first time, he could watch his subjects without anybody knowing he was there. And he watched them, each one through, with the greatest of interest. And with reluctance, he finally came back to me. So we came back into our area and shut these big doors. Arrived up at the headquarters open air end, and at this stage we asked him if he would sign our visitor's book, which he did. So I then said, "Well, I wonder if you would like a cup of tea," despite the general's orders. And he said, "Yes, indeed, I would. Will you have it here or will you have it in my office?" I think, looking around at all the officers looking at him, he said, "I'll have it in your office." So we went into my office, followed, I must admit, by the general and the post office representative there, a civilian, who was a cockney and a wag, and he told the king the story that that very day he'd been home, and the night before something had happened in the way of bombing, and unknown to him, his boiler was out of order, and he lit it, and we were all blown out into the garden, which amused the king eventually. He said, "You know, you should be very careful with that kind of thing. When I used to be responsible in the early days, I used to go always in the winter into our cellars and control the water for the building myself." And I thought that was a very good idea. Anyway, he looked at me as if it was about time he had his cup of tea, you see, and there was a knock at the door, and in came my very efficient mess servant and all the mess men wearing the brilliant white and blue striped jackets of the Royal Corps of Signals peacetime mess wear, and all with the badges and everything right about them, and bearing plates of cream buns and things that they'd obtained from Harrods. But best of all was a tray, a large silver tray held by the corporal, and on this the most impressive tea service the one could have ever chosen, with cups almost as large as soup bowls, and the whole of it in a brilliant crimson and gold. I think even the king himself must have been slightly surprised at that. He couldn't easily produce similar conditions at Buckingham Palace. Well, they settled down and they ate the buns, they drank tea, the king thanked me very kindly. I took his hat and stick and gloves and took him out to his car, he put them on, wished me goodbye, and I went back to my office. Within a few minutes the general came through to me and he said, "Arthur, how did you manage that?" They always called me Arthur. I regret to say the rest of his officers called me Uncle Arthur, which I think a bit uncalled for. But anyway, he said, "There must have been an answer to that." I said, "Well, my messing officer obtained this uniform from the regulars at St. John's Wood, but he then was rather depressed and went to have a drink at the Bunch of Grapes over the road. He told the manager of his sorrow, 'We've got a very important guest coming.' He wouldn't tell him who. The manager said, 'Well, look, here's the tea service that we've had in this cupboard, given to us by the publicans of London to celebrate our wedding. We will have it cleaned and polished and ready for you, and that is where we got it from.'" And that was the answer why the king was so impressed by our tea service.
Well, you certainly did him in style, didn't you? And Lieutenant Colonel Hemsley, thank you very much indeed for telling me so many of your experiences in both world wars. Thank you very much.
Is that going to be